Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, it's Jack. I'm reading some articles from the October issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Keep Calm and Cowgirl On. From the editors of CNI. No less a force of nature than Dolly Parton uttered a pithy philosophy that could well be the mantra of the wonderful women highlighted in this special issue. Don't be a lady, she said. Be a legend. It's a theme that crops up among extraordinary women. I figured if a girl wants to be a legend, she should just go ahead and be one, declared Calamity Jane, who clearly followed her own advice. We've dedicated this issue to singular females, daughters, sisters, wives, mothers, entrepreneurs, activists, singers, actors, artists, who distinguish themselves with a certain kind of drive to be different, do more, help others, take up the mantle, blaze the trail, say yes to the challenge. You might call the thing that animates and empowers them a kind of cowgirl code. Cowgirl is an attitude, really, a pioneer spirit, a special American brand of courage, Dale Evans said. Wife and professional partner of Roy Rogers, and a talented star and dedicated philanthropist in her own right, she's one of the many luminaries we celebrate in leading ladies of the silver screen. Marilyn Monroe, whose turn in The Misfits makes our list of top memorable performances in a Western, seemed to know something about that cowgirl quality, too. Give a girl the right pair of boots, Monroe said, and she can conquer the world. For their accomplishments and the high regard we hold them in, you might even call the women who make up this special issue rock stars. Now that Dolly has fulfilled yet another dream, this time to record a rock album, which comes out in November, she's quite literally a rock star. In her mid-70s, the perennial impressive Parton set out to earn the credibility she wasn't sure she had when she was inducted into the 2022 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But we've always known Dolly Parton was a rock star in the bigger sense of the term. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's essay about Dolly succinctly sums up her trailblazing rock star rise. Nearly 60 years after she left her East Tennessee home at 18 to make it in Nashville, writes Holly George Warren, Parton has deftly engaged her vast talent, unique persona, and sheer determination to forge a near unparalleled career. From country music star to crossover superstar to movie star to global icon to beloved humanitarian and philanthropist. Through it all, 100 million album sales later, she's remained a storyteller supreme. Robert Orman, who has known and worked alongside her for four decades, wrote Our Dolly cover story, tracing a trajectory that only a dreamer-in-chief could have charted. If there are common denominators among the trailblazing women of the West profiled in this issue, they might be dreams, determination, grit, and gumption. And as our wonderful fall fashion feature attests, the right pair of boots never hurts. Read their stories and be inspired. Then go out and blaze your own trail. Dolly, Country's Rock Star, by Robert K. Orman. Her official title in her business empire is Dreamer-in-Chief, and that's appropriate for the ambitious aspirations of Dolly Parton. Let's start where she did, with her music. The superstar's latest metamorphosis is rock star, a 30-song opus that takes aim at the rock music marketplace. Inspired by her 2022 unexpected election to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it finds her tackling rock classics as well as showcasing her own songwriting for the genre. Dolly has previously devoted herself to such diverse styles as gospel, bluegrass, disco, children's music, pop, folk, musical theater, and rockabilly. Rockstar, which comes out in November, is her 49th studio album and merely the latest in a long string of career dreams. This child of Appalachian poverty dreamed of becoming a country queen and a pop music hitmaker. She dreamed of being a movie star, a tourism mogul, an author, a philanthropist, and a Broadway success. They say a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Well, I say a dream is a terrible thing to waste, Dolly declares, and I've always been a big dreamer. I was born a dreamer. During the past 5 years, Dolly Parton has extended her brand to encompass everything from perfume to pet products. She already has her very own movie company, song publishing business, soundstage, hotel, museum, and record label. Big business is not as scary as it seems, remarks the platinum powerhouse. I find my common sense and the fact that I was born and raised in the country are the greatest gifts that I possess. Just having good horse sense, you can make more money and get more done than all the people that got to fumble through their books to try to find an answer to something. She has called her ambitions putting wings on my dreams. The butterfly is her symbol. She has emerged from one cocoon after another to spread her sparkly wings and fly. When I first arrived in Nashville, conservatives in the country music community were in a snit about Dolly moving to Los Angeles record production and aiming for pop music stardom. You would have thought she'd stomped a kitten in the middle of Music Row. She memorably told her detractors, "I'm not leaving country music. I'm taking it with me." The success of Here You Come Again, Two Doors Down, and her other pop records of 1977 to 79 silenced the naysayers. Pop music was just a taste of what was to come. She released the disco hit Baby I'm Burnin' in 1979 and continued to issue dance club remixes during the next three decades. Her Faith collaboration with the Swedish art Galantis became a number one dance music smash in 2020. Dolly's Heart Songs album of 1994 featured her versions of mountain folk songs. Dolly turned to the bluegrass genre for The Grass is Blue, 1999, and Little Sparrow, 2001. The former won a Bluegrass Grammy Award. Her gospel bona fides go back to when she released her first gospel collection in 1971 and The Seeker as a big country hit in 1975. She took home Grammys for gospel hits in 2020, God Only Knows with For King in country, and 2021 There Was Jesus with Zach Williams. She delved into children's music with 2017's I Believe in You. She topped the holiday hit parade with A Holly Dolly Christmas in 2020. Dolly's musical experiments have included duets with such diverse folks as Rod Stewart, Smokey Robinson, Julio Iglesias, Nora Jones, Don Henley, Neil Diamond, Solomon Burke, Keisha, Dionne Warwick, and dozens of her fellow country stars. One of her most memorable collaborations was with Kenny Rogers on the chart-topping Islands in the Stream in 1983. She sang with Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris on the Grammy-winning 2 million-selling and stunningly beautiful Trio LP of 1987. It remains a landmark of women's music. I was in Los Angeles on business in 1986 when Emmy Lou told me that something extraordinary was happening in a recording studio across town. She was bursting with excitement about the music the three were working on. When they staged a press conference for the album at the posh Sheraton Premier Hotel, high above Universal City in the spring of 1987, it was a media-feeding frenzy. The three posed together for photos, then separated to occupy the different hotel suites to greet her smitten journalists one by one. "Dolly's voice is almost the focal point of this record," said Emmy Lou. "Dolly represents the finest of women's traditional music." The trio album spawned four major country hits, including their version of Dolly's brilliant song, Wildflowers. Songs are the basis of Donnie's empire. She's written more than 3,000 of them. In 1974, she formed her own publishing company to control sole ownership of her copyrights. She even founded her own record label in 1994. I thought, well, shit, this is the music business. Why not think of the business end of the business, she recalls. I figure if God gave me this talent, he also meant for me to have a good sense with it. And that means good business sense. Jolene is her most recorded composition, with versions by everyone from bluegrass bands to punk rockers. An arrangement of it pairing Dolly with the a cappella group Pentatonix earned her a Grammy in 2017. I Will Always Love You has been a hit for Dolly four times and became one of the biggest pop successes in history when Whitney Houston recorded it. Houston's single remained at number one on the pop charts for four straight months in 1992-93. Bringing its songwriter an enormous financial bounty in royalties. Those are just two of the songs that made me a Dolly fan. I wept the first time I heard Coat of Many Colors. I thought, if this is what country music is now, I need to move to Nashville. When I first started interviewing her, I was so thoroughly in awe of dazzling Dolly that I couldn't even look at her. I stared down at my reporter's notepad or at the tape recorder. She was so beautiful that I was afraid I'd forget my next question, become a babbling fool, or turn to stone if I looked into her gray-blue eyes. I met Dolly Parton when she was fulfilling one of her biggest dreams. No female country singer before Dolly had been so nervy as to imagine herself as a Hollywood movie star. Her silver screen debut was 9 to 5 with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin. It became the third highest grossing film of 1981, trailing the blockbusters Raiders of the Lost Ark and Superman II. Moreover, her mega hit title song earned Dolly two Grammy Awards and an Oscar nomination. She followed 9 to 5 with 1982's The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, co-starring Burt Reynolds. It became her second box office smash. Rhinestone, 1984, and Straight Talk, 1992, were flops, but her 2012 gospel musical Joyful Noise with Queen Latifah broke even. I don't judge things by how much money they make or how good for the reviews are, she says. I just base it on how much fun it was or how much I got out of it. Money is not what motivates me, adds the woman who is worth, they say, more than $440 million. The opportunity to achieve is even more important to me. The female ensemble film Steel Magnolias, 1989, co-starring Dolly with Sally Field, Shirley MacLaine, Daryl Hannah, Olympia Dukakis, and Julia Roberts, was her triumph. It was also a box office bonanza, grossing nearly $136 million. I don't know. I seem to have my best luck working with other women, she says, referencing 9 to 5, Steel Magnolias, Trio, and her 1994 Honky Tonk Angels album with fellow legends Loretta Lynn and Tammy Wynette. She wrote the vibrant Eagle When She Flies for Steel Magnolias, but it didn't make it into the film. When Dolly released the song as a single and video in 1991, country radio's male programmers said it was too feminist. Dolly was nominated for her second Academy Award for her song Travelin' Through, which she wrote for 2005's Transamerica. The film centers on a transgender character, and she has long been an open supporter of LGBTQ+ issues. I believe in rights for all people, Dolly says. I just think we're all God's children and should be treated with respect. Always dreaming up new ventures, Dolly teamed with manager Sandy Gallen to form a movie production company in 1986. Sand Dollar Entertainment won an Academy Award in 1990 for the AIDS documentary Common Threads, Stories from the Quilt. Her film firm has also been behind Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Sabrina, and Father of the Bride, as well as many of her own projects. She has been particularly successful with TV movies, A Smoky Mountain Christmas, 1986, Wild Texas Wind, 1991, Unlikely Angel, 1996, Blue Valley Songbird, 1999, Code of Many Colors, 2015, Christmas of Many Colors, 2016, Christmas of Dollywood, 2019, and Christmas on the Square, 2020, all earned solid ratings. In 2019, Netflix aired 8 films based on her songs. One of the star's best-known ventures is Dollywood. In 1986, I traveled to East Tennessee for the theme park's grand opening. So did 20,000 others, including hundreds of journalists. The Sevier High School band struck up 9 to 5, while Dolly cut a red, white, and blue ribbon with giant shears as 1,986 balloons were released carrying free tickets to the park. "Oh, I feel good," she crowed to the crowd. "Dollywood's aim is to make you feel as important every day as I feel today." A bright yellow billboard in Sevierville read, "Dollywood, a dream come true." The park contains a replica of the mountain cabin she grew up in. Her rags-to-riches saga is also depicted in her Chasing Rainbows museum there. I was delighted when I discovered that one of its displays included a film clip of me talking about her. The park also offers thrill rides, an eagle rehabilitation sanctuary, Appalachian craftspeople, theaters, and a gospel music museum. Dollywood is visited by about 3 million people each season. Does she ride its roller coasters? Not on your life. My wig would fly off. Between 2001 and 2018, she acquired the nearby Splash Country Water Adventure Park, Smoky Mountain Cabins, Pirate Voyage and Stampede Dinner Shows, and the luxurious Dream More Resort Hotel. Dolly says that her one mission of her tourism complex is to create jobs for the many impoverished families in this pocket of Appalachia. "You should put pride in people," she says. "Everybody that's fortunate enough to make it ought to give something back. Dollywood is providing jobs for so many people." The Dollywood Foundation supports scholarships and nonprofit organizations that improve the quality of life for people in need. The foundation's My People Fund was established in 2016 when the Great Smoky Mountain wildfire killed 14 people and burned down thousands of homes and businesses in Sevier County. Dolly hosted a telethon that helped to raise more than $9 million in assistance. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit in 2020, Dolly donated $1 million to Vanderbilt University Medical Center for research. This led to the development of the Moderna vaccine. She released her pandemic-inspired When Life is Good Again the week the U.S. death toll topped the 100,000 mark. As of this June, there have been 1,167,622 U.S. coronavirus deaths. Dolly's many charitable ventures resulted in her receiving the prestigious Carnegie Medal of Philanthropy in 2023. Dolly's Imagination Library is her foundation's best-known charity. Launched in 1995, the program promotes literacy by gifting free books monthly to infants and children up to age 5. Nearly 2 million children are enrolled. In 2018, the Library of Congress celebrated the Imagination Library's donation of its 100 millionth book. The first book a baby gets is The Little Engine That Could, because Dolly says, "I'm the little engine that did." Many children call her the Book Lady. She's also a book author. Her autobiography, Dolly, My Life and Other Unfinished Business, became a New York Times bestseller in 1994. So she dreamed up a string of others. These include her debut novel, Run, Rose, Run, 2022. Co-written with the prolific mystery writer James Patterson, the book debuted at number 1 on the fiction lists of the New York Times, U.S. Today, and the Washington Post. Her positive thinking advice column volume, Dream More, Celebrate the Dreamer in You, 2014, became a popular audiobook. Dolly has also written the children's books I Am a Rainbow, 2009, Coat of Many Colors, 2016, and Billy the Kid Makes It Big, 2023. I've done dozens of feature stories about her, penned her press kits, written liner notes for her records, and created Dolly documentaries for TV. But nothing topped collaborating with her on Songteller, My Life in Lyrics. Released in late 2020, it became another New York Times bestseller. The book features stories behind her hits, as well as such topical tunes as her 9/11-inspired Hello God, her A Woman's Right, celebrating the 100th anniversary of Votes for Women, her self-descriptive Backwoods Barbie, and her Imagination Library theme, Try, as well as her COVID-inspired lyrics. Working with Dolly, I learned that her energy level is astonishing. After interviewing for a full day, I'd be exhausted, but she'd want to keep going into the evening. I might look like a show pony, but I'm a workhorse, she says. While we were working on Songteller, I suggested that her flamboyant costumes should have a book of their own. Dolly will issue Behind the Seams, My Life in Rhinestones, as a collaboration with Holly George Warden, coming out this fall. Dolly Parton has also written for the stage, 9 to 5, the musical, opened on Broadway in 2009, and earned 4 Tony Award nominations. The musical continues to be a popular roadshow attraction. I've always speculated that the hardest part about working for Dolly would be simply keeping up with her. During the past 3 years, she's been dreaming in overdrive. She launched her Duncan Hines Dolly Parton baking collection of cake, biscuit, brownie, and cornbread mixes. Doggy Parton is a line of pet apparel and accessories. Dolly Scent From Above is her fragrance brand, available at Walmart. Dolly Parton Kitchenware, dishes, mugs, towels, teapots, etc., is at stores such as Hobby Lobby, Kohl's, and JCPenney. There's also a new Dolly Parton partyware brand of napkins, disposable plates, and cutlery. Behind the Scenes, My Life in Rhinestones, is due on October 17th. Rockstar's release date is November 17th. It brings her music full circle from her teenage rockabilly singles Puppy Love, 1960, It's Sure Gonna Hurt, 1962, and What Do You Think About Lovin', 1964, to new rocking collaborations with Sting, Elton John, Lizzo, Paul McCartney, Miley Cyrus, Stevie Nicks, John Fogerty, Pink, Joan Jett, and other dream duet partners. When I was a little kid, I dreamed I was singing to a lot of people when I was singing to my brothers and sisters, the chickens and the hogs, she reminisces. I'm very proud of my humble beginnings. I'm proud of the fact that dreams can come true for simple people, ordinary people. I was very blessed to see so many of my dreams come true. You have to believe in your dreams. Brave-hearted women. We talk with author Katie Hickman about her new book and some of its standout women who migrated west across the treacherous frontier, by Kate Nelson. For far too long, the American West canon has centered around men, with larger-than-life personas like Buffalo Bill, Wyatt Earp, and Jesse James burned into our collective memory. But these enduring tales of cowboys and outlaws overlook the pivotal role women played during that era. To set the record straight, best-selling British author Katie Hickman dug into the real-life accounts of the women who helped shape the West, from the white settlers who made the treacherous cross-country journey to the African-American slaves who accompanied them to the Native American tribes who had long inhabited those lands. As brilliantly told in Brave-Hearted, The Women of the American West, the interplay of their inextricably intertwined existences paints a fuller picture. The author of 10 history-focused books, Hickman spent months poring over diaries, letters, and personal accounts in order to tell these stories that are at once singular and symbolic. She admits that the book in its final form was much different than the one she set out to write, largely due to those characterized depictions of the West that are so familiar for many of us. Along the way, she developed a deep connection with the women whose tales she deftly weaves together in this tapestry-like tome. So much of how we perceive the American West is through movies, which were based partly on truth, but were mostly fantasy, she explains. If we look back in history, men were the ones making the movies, telling these very male stories that offered an unreconstructed idea of what a man was and often omitted relevant historical background. Women were highly romanticized, and Native Americans were demonized in order to justify their displacement and killing. It was the story people wanted to tell themselves at the time. When I set out to write the book, I thought it was going to be a pretty straightforward story about the women who were a part of it all. But when I began to research, I realized the narrative arc was actually a story about migration. To set the scene, the Great Migration began in earnest in 1840, when the United States comprised just 26 states. The so-called frontier was an idealized place that lay west of the Mississippi River, much of it dubbed Indian or unorganized territory. Although white men had previously ventured there to hunt and trap, it wasn't until women made the journey that white families began to put down roots, building homesteads and farms. What began as a handful of wayfaring groups quickly turned into tens of thousands of nomads within a matter of years, thanks to depictions of destinations like California and Oregon as bountiful escapes from the economic hardships of the East. The turbulence experienced on this months-long expedition is not to be downplayed, Hickman notes. Settlers' naive optimism soon soured as they encountered challenging conditions that defied their improbable expectations. The harsh realities they faced stood in stark contrast to the pastoral pictures portrayed in Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House on the Prairie series. Countless people nearly starved, fell ill, or perished along the way. Inadequate supply reserves were strictly rationed or ran out altogether. Loads had to be lightened for exhausted, hungry oxen and horses, with personal possessions like clothing, trunks, and bookcases abandoned along the trail. As part of my research, I took a road trip down the California Trail from Independence, Missouri, and the idea that these families covered thousands of miles in a wagon and on foot is simply astonishing. Most of these women were just ordinary women who were trying to do their best for their families and who got swept up in this great movement. They were not the ones killing Native Americans. They were not the ones signing treaties that reneged on the conditions. These migrating women came from all classes, backgrounds, and ethnicities, many of them poorly represented in historical accounts. They have only one thing in common, Hickman writes. Whoever they were and wherever they came from, their decision to uproot themselves from everything they held dear and make the journey west was the defining moment of their lives. Hickman admits to having a love-hate relationship with the missionaries like Eliza Spaulding and Narcissa Whitman, the first white women to make this unheard-of journey for females in 1836. I hate the idea of missionaries thinking they can go into another culture and try to convert them to a supposedly superior worldview. On the other hand, if you were a woman with ambition in the mid-19th century, there was nowhere for that ambition to go. You were relegated to being a wife and a mother, or you could be a missionary. Narcissa Whitman believed she was doing a good thing and gave up absolutely everything to do it. But ultimately, they didn't make any converts, and instead totally alienated the Cayuse people, who all died because of the diseases brought in. Her only daughter died, and she ended up being killed. A dreadful life, indeed. Many black women, both enslaved and free, also went west. Among the most remarkable is Biddy Mason, who was born into slavery, but went on to become one of the first African-American landowners in Los Angeles. She and her three children embarked on the expedition in 1848 with Robert Smith's family and the Mississippi Mormons, who were following Brigham Young's call to build the kingdom of God. Despite having no formal education, Mason was adept at livestock management, a skill put to use during the 7 months on the trail. After a 3-year stopover in Utah, the Smith clan decamped to California. Although the state's new constitution prohibited slavery, many people ignored the law and faced no consequences. As attitudes on this shifted in the early 1850s, Smith felt compelled to move his troop out of California to avoid losing ownership of his so-called possessions. But Mason and her family, now even larger with the passage of time, had the support of notable freed blacks like Elizabeth Flake and Robert Owens, who petitioned the local court on their behalf. This prompted a dramatic legal battle replete with bribery, threats, and similarly unsavory tactics. Notably, as Hickman points out, if the trial had taken place just a year later in 1857, it would have been governed by the U.S. Supreme Court's Dred Scott decision that a slave's residence in a free state or territory, did not make that slave free. But in the case of Mason versus Smith, the judge ruled in Mason's favor, granting her family a freedom they had never experienced that ultimately allowed her to shape history. Biddy Mason's story is extraordinary, Hickman says. She went to court to find her freedom, then became a very successful midwife, and one of the first African Americans to own property in Los Angeles. It's absolutely remarkable. Of course, the free land that lured settlers west wasn't free at all. For millennia, It had been inhabited by countless Native American communities with sophisticated societal structures, rich cultural traditions, and an interconnected way of life. There were not very many Native American accounts, but the ones I found were very instructive and so beautifully written, Hickman explains, acknowledging that much indigenous oral history has unfortunately been lost over time. The language was so poetic, even though these women were chronicling the end of a way of life, a Holocaust, really. The material is very intense and difficult to read, but these first-person accounts are so powerful because you realize that this was an actual person and that it actually happened to them. They're really shocking tales. Particularly informative are the recollections of Sarah Winnemucca of the Northern Paiute tribe, who resided across what is now Northern Nevada, Eastern California, and Southern Oregon. I was very small child when the first white people came into our country, she writes in her 1883 book, Life Among the Paiutes, the first known autobiography by a Native American woman. They came like a lion, yes, like a roaring lion, and have continued so ever since, and I have never forgotten their first coming. Winnemucca went on to become an educator, a U.S. Army interpreter, and a tireless activist and advocate for her people. Early on during this mass migration, there was coexistence, even intermarriage, with Native American tribes often assisting ill-equipped settlers as they encountered unforeseen challenges. There was a moment when people were living harmoniously together, Hickman says. It makes you wonder if the number of settlers had been far fewer, if white people would have had a better way to live alongside the original Native inhabitants. It was really a numbers game, given the sheer number of people trying to get to Oregon and California, especially after gold was discovered, who saw the Native people as an impediment to what they wanted. The Paiute originally welcomed white settlers in part because of tribal mythology that they would one day be reunited with their white brethren. But these friendly overtures were doomed from the beginning because of the literal fairy tales that white people had been told about what might happen if they met Native Americans. Hickman says, alluding to the extreme brutality that resulted in the decimation of so many Native American communities. In modern-day California alone, she writes, it's estimated that the indigenous population diminished from 150,000 in 1848 to fewer than 30,000 by 1870. The violence that so many tribal peoples experienced is embodied in the story of Sally Bell, as she became known by the white settlers who eventually took her in. A member of the Sinkione tribe of Northern California, she was but a child when the Needle Rock Massacre took place, in which a vigilante militia destroyed her village and killed most of her family before her very eyes. They killed my grandfather and my mother and my father. I saw them do it, a passage of Bell's personal account reads. I was a big girl at the time. Then they killed my baby sister and cut her heart out and threw it in the brush, where I ran and hid. My little sister was just a baby, just crawling around. I didn't know what to do. I was so scared that I guess I just hid there a long time with my little sister's heart in my hands. But it is Josephine Wagoner, a woman of Hunkpapa, Lakota, and Irish heritage, who led a life of overlapping worlds, who Hickman considers the heroine of her book. In fact, seemingly serendipitous timing allowed Hickman access to Wagoner's tome, Witness, a Hunkpapa historian's Songheart Song of the Lakotas, published in 2013, 70 years after her death. The compilation of decades' worth of interviews with elders, historians, and other knowledge keepers, This seminal work offers rare first-hand and has told two stories about life in the Lakota heartland, including 60 biographies of tribal leaders. For Hickman, this uncovers the importance of her efforts to map history onto history. My whole writing life has been dedicated to bringing out women's stories because for so long they got pushed to the side. People thought their testimony wasn't interesting or important, but these women's stories have great power. So many of them are about life and death. As the temporary custodian of these stories, I felt a great responsibility to tell them as truthfully as possible. Though the tales of Bravehearted are rooted in the 19th century American West, the book's lessons span both space and time. The biggest takeaway is that we should listen to everyone's story carefully, no matter who they are. The more different someone is from you, the more carefully you should pay attention to their story. The modern equivalent to this is the immigration issue we're both seeing in both the United States and Britain. People are scared of immigrants because they think of them as this amorphous, faceless mass, not actual human beings. But as soon as you sit down and listen to someone's story, they become a human being with whom you naturally feel a connection. Georgia O'Keeffe, the mother of American modernism. Answering the call of the desert, Georgia O'Keeffe traded the frenzy of New York City for a life of solitude at a pair of New Mexico properties and became a creative force for all time. By Laura Castelny. When Georgia O'Keeffe made the 60-mile trek from her home and studio in Abiquiu to Santa Fe for health reasons back in 1984, she fully expected to come back. Sadly, she passed away 2 years later at the age of 98 without a single return trip. That means that, unlike many homes-turned-museums, her residence remains largely as it was the day she left. What has changed in the last four decades is that O'Keeffe is now largely synonymous with New Mexico, and every year more than 12,000 people make the pilgrimage to that 5,000-square-foot hacienda and studio to study the traditional adobe architecture, stroll through her gorgeous gardens, and take in the mid-century modern decor. To get an even better understanding of how O'Keeffe lived, Justina Renzoni, curator of historic properties at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, says it's helpful to get a sense of how the artist's work, travels, and love for the landscape influenced her design choices. Many artists, especially if they're female, have to suffer through a miserable life and die before their work gets any respect from the establishment. Georgia O'Keeffe was not one of them. She was really a rare example of a woman artist who was successful within her lifetime, Renzoni says. While the $44 million sale of Jimson Weed White Flower No. 1 happened almost 30 years after her death, incidentally, the sale remains the highest ever achieved for a painting by a female artist at auction. Renzoni notes that O'Keeffe's reputation as a well-respected modernist dates all the way back to the 1940s. Her pieces sold for quite a lot of money during her lifetime through her husband Alfred Stieglitz's gallery, so she was very well known and independently wealthy. Part of what allowed O'Keeffe to become so successful was her willingness to stay open to new experiences, something that differentiated her from many of her contemporaries. She didn't conform to society's standards. She was always a risk-taker, and she was willing to push the boundaries of what it meant to be a woman at that time. She was very aware of her gender, but she didn't want that to be her defining characteristic. She wanted to be considered an equal as an artist. That openness extended especially to her travels. She liked living adventurously and she was okay with roughing it, the museum curator explains. Born in a farmhouse to dairy farmers in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, in 1887, she eventually moved with her family to Virginia, then took art classes in Chicago, New York, and Virginia, striking out on her own art career by teaching art in South Carolina and West Texas, where she was inspired by the beauty of Palladora Canyon. O'Keeffe liked to camp in rural parts of West Texas and New Mexico, and went whitewater rafting on the Colorado River for the very first time at age 74. She loved it so much that she went 10 more times. Once international travel became more accessible in the 1950s, she began taking incredible trips to places like Thailand, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Egypt. Unlimited curiosity is so critical to artists' points of view, and she was looking for cultural experiences. It's something I really admire about her, her willingness to subject herself to discomfort in order to deepen her relationship with nature. When she wasn't touring the Far East or painting at her New York City studio, O'Keeffe headed west. She was introduced to New Mexico by way of Taos and spent a few summers with friends and fellow creatives like Rebecca Salisbury James and D.H. Lawrence in the 1930s. There was already a real trend of artists coming to Taos, and when O'Keeffe arrived, she initially stayed within a group setting. But O'Keeffe was notoriously private, so she had little interest in joining an artist colony long term. Instead, she was drawn to towns like Alcade and Abiquiu. When she went out into the desert there, she immediately experienced a solitude that's impossible to find in an urban setting. The need to access the landscape alone actually inspired O'Keeffe to learn how to drive. She even purchased a totally customized Model A Ford that she drove from New York to New Mexico for her creative retreats. The passenger seat could be removed to make room for a table, and the driver's side seat swiveled so she could paint on a canvas. She essentially created a mobile studio, Renzoni says. O'Keeffe preferred plain air and in situ painting, so she just got in the car, drove through the arroyos out to the desert, and painted anywhere she liked. In 1916, she had met influential photographer and gallery owner Alfred Stieglitz in New York. He had an eye and affinity for modernist talent and had come upon some charcoal drawings O'Keeffe had done. Without her knowledge or permission, he put on a show of her work at his famed 291 gallery. When she went to 291 to complain, fate changed course. She fell into romance first with modernist photographer Paul Strand, and then with Stieglitz. She would become Stieglitz's muse, the subject of countless black and white portraits and nudes, and eventually his wife. In 1918, on his promise of a quiet studio where she could paint, she moved from Texas to New York. The two married in 1924 and would become one of the most storied, if complicated, unions in modern art history. Said Susan Strandberg in a story for NPR on the first volume of their collected letters, "It was a very modern marriage, with changes, variations, temptations and infidelity, and, of course, letters, which lasted until Stieglitz died in 1946. Throughout, each groped for personal and professional fulfillment and achieved so much." But it was in New Mexico that O'Keeffe would find the quiet she sought, and she journeyed there frequently. After Stieglitz's death in 1946, she made the move to New Mexico permanently. She headed for her remote retreat, a cabin on a small parcel of land purchased from friends within the 21,000-acre Ghost Ranch, just outside of Abiquiu. The sublime surroundings inspired her work in a very literal way. Paintings produced there include My Front Yard, My Backyard, and The Place I Live In. Renzoni says the specificity of the names is hardly surprising to anyone who visits the area. To outsiders, it's hard to put your finger on what exactly it is about this area that makes it so special. There's something so fantastical about the landscape. It's very diverse geologically. There are bright white canyons, and up the road, there's a gigantic red canyon. And the sky is so expansive here, it's also bluer. O'Keefe later purchased a winter home a mere 13 miles away in the heart of Abiquiu. Why would she buy two homes so close together? Despite the proximity, they're in two totally different environments, Renzoni says. The Abiquiu home has a whole different landscape, a lush valley where she could have a lush garden with lots of fruit trees and flowers. She also had neighbors there, so it was a more social place, as opposed to her ghost ranch home, which is really remote with sandy soil, less water, and less green. However, turning the winter property into a home and studio fit for company was no easy task. Prior to purchasing the circuit 1750s adobe structure, O'Keefe had spent 10 years trying to persuade the Catholic Church to sell. When they finally relented, the place was in ruins. Undeterred, the artist brought in foremen, make that four women, Maria Chabot, to oversee the complete renovation. It was very unusual to have a woman in that role, but Maria was confident, fluent in Spanish, and very capable of working with the building community and artisans who were experts in adobe construction. The latter skill proved incredibly important. While the team worked within the original footprint and added amenities like indoor plumbing, they also ended up having to craft more than 22,000 adobe bricks to reconstruct. Once the renovation was complete in 1949, O'Keefe moved in and began making her mark on the light-filled interiors with a mix of modern furnishings and natural elements. Everyone who visits is always blown away by how deliberate the design is, starting with the color ranges of the adobe. Each room has its own visual character, different ceiling types, and wall treatments. She embraced the idea of finding beauty in every single part of her home, and she continued to design it throughout her life, changing the decor and the furnishings. She really liked to think of her home as her work as well. Even as this design scheme evolved, O'Keefe always made room for her impressive library, which was filled with beloved novels and dog-eared nonfiction that covered a host of topics, including gardening, cooking, and chow-chows, her breed of choice. She also loved music and had top-of-the-line speakers installed in her studio and sitting areas. She loved nothing more than heading to a sitting room at the end of the day, lying in a lounge chair and listening to classical music. When it came to accessories, O'Keefe preferred carving out space for the rocks, skulls, and bones she unearthed on her daily walks over a more traditional art collection. She was fond of a blank wall and rarely displayed the artwork of other artists in her home. She worried that it could interfere with her own work. Still, she made room for select items, including a landscape by Arthur Dove, a mobile by Alexander Calder, and folk art and ceramics purchased on her travels. As the artist's health started to worsen, she began losing her eyesight at age 84 and eventually moved in frail health to Santa Fe, where she would die of natural causes just short of a century mark. She began to consider turning her home into a museum. O'Keefe opted not to bequeath her home to the National Park Service, but she was okay with the idea that her home could be opened to the public as long as no major changes were made to the property. Ghost Ranch is now operated by the Presbyterian Church and available for workshops and visits. O'Keefe's home at Ghost Ranch is not open to the public. The Georgia O'Keefe Foundation was established after her death in 1989, and the home opened to the public in early 1990s with the expectation that maybe she'd do tours for 5 years or so, and then everyone who had an interest would have seen it. The foundation no longer exists, and the Georgia O'Keefe Museum now maintains both the O'Keefe's homes. Here we are today, and the demand shows no sign of slowing down. Still, the curator emphasizes that touring the home is only part of the Georgia O'Keefe's experience. A sense of place was so important to her. I always encourage visitors to not just tour the home and studio. Get out in the landscape, on a hike or picnic. Visit some local stores. Eat the food. She would really want you to get the full picture.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.